telling me about your protagonist who's growing up in like a 70s suburban California world.
So Julie is a young girl, an only child, growing up on a suburban cul-de-sac in Southern California, which is a lot like where I grew up. And, you know, she's a little bit on the quieter side. She's sort of sensitive.
Kind of woman who might grow up to be an editor.
Yes, you know, I certainly drew a little on my own, especially on her, drew on my own memories of that time as in terms of her emotions and her personality. I mean, I had to make up all the events that happened to her because my childhood was a lot more stable and pleasant than hers. But, you know, I do remember, so for Julia, this is sort of a difficult time. You know, she's realizing that some of her friendships that seemed so sturdy before can fall away really quickly, especially at that age. But at the same time, you know, friendships can form really quickly, and she's kind of falling in love for the first time, you know, realizing that the adults around her and her parents are not perfect, that they have flaws. And she has a sort of extreme self-consciousness, as a lot of young girls, I think, and maybe boys too, at that age do. She's just very worried about where she fits in, where she's going to fit into the world, and especially among her peers. And all those feelings are things that I remember feeling when I was 11.
And a lot of it is just that first kind of, you know, first kiss, first kind of fumbling around in the dark in a closet
game. Right.
First time you get betrayed by a friend.
Right.
All that awkward, unpleasant stuff, plus there's awkward, unpleasant stuff happening outside.
Right. Yeah, I mean, I liked the idea of exploring both of those things at the same time. And I think to me, as I wrote the book, all those ordinary awkwardnesses and joys, you know, of growing up, they started to seem even more meaningful or more clearly meaningful in the context of this looming catastrophe. Because, you know, what if this is the last generation who's to be going through all these, you know, ordinary and sometimes painful experiences, all these firsts, as you say. So there was something poignant in my mind as I wrote the book about every small detail in their lives.
The world is sort of gets offset by a few minutes, what, right. 56 minutes at the beginning is the first time they really
right.
notice how,
mm-hmm.
and it just gets steadily worse. And then there's a schism between people who decide to hold on to the clock and follow it slavishly, and people who just go, okay, it's light out, I'll be awake,
right.
start, go asleep.
Yeah, you know, pretty early in the process, as I started to write this book, I realized that if the rotation of the Earth slowed down so that the sort of Earth day becomes, you know, 25 hours, 26 hours, 27 hours, and especially because it keeps growing, I felt like society or the government would have to come to some sort of decision to preserve order so that everyone was on, you know, most people would be on the same clock. So what they do is they reimpose the 24-hour clock, even though it means now that darkness and light no longer correspond to the days. So it could be one morning kids go to school in the dark, and then the next morning it might be bright sunshine. It's just completely out of sync. With the days as we know them now. I mean, the clocks are completely out of sync. Anyway, but as soon as I made that decision, I knew that there would be some people who would resist it, who would feel that was, you know, artificial and maybe just sort of wrong to live that way, and that those people would want to live in a way that was more natural and more organic, and those people become known as the real timers because they live their lives according to the rising and the setting of the sun, even as it becomes more and more unpredictable.
And suddenly become a new persecuted minority.
Right, right. You know, I have this feeling, because it's true, the clock timers, as the others are called, react with a lot of hostility to the real timers. And I felt that the reason that I made that decision or that it's the way that the book unfolded is because I felt like, well, for one thing, in times of fear and uncertainty, I think we're always more likely to treat people who are different in a hostile way. And then, but in this scenario, when so much is changing, you know, the very fabric of our days have changed so that even sunrise and sunset can't be counted on. In that situation, I felt that the people who were living on the clock would begin to hold even more strongly to the clock, because the clock would be the 24-hour clock that tells them when it's morning according to the clock and when it's night according to the clock, would become even more meaningful than it is now, because it's sort of this illusion of normalcy, and it's their only way to cling to ordinary life and order. And so that I felt like the real timers would seem like a threat to those people, and it would be like a threat to the social order. And so that's why I thought that the clock timers would treat the real timers badly.
Really good job.
Oh, thank you. Thanks so much.
And not just the science fiction stuff, but I felt like I was an 11-year-old girl at times.
Good.
Reading it.
I guess that's good.
That was disturbing, but I enjoyed it.
Good. Oh, good. Well, I'm glad.
The book is The Age of Miracles. It's the first novel by Karen Thompson Walker, and The Age of Miracles, published by Bond Street Books, distributed in Canada by Random House.